Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, and welcome to the 68th episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni, and you can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd.
My name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. And just want to take a minute to just ask you to do us a favor, and if you could go leave us a rating in iTunes, it would be greatly appreciated. If you enjoy the show or listen to past episodes, it helps us out a bunch. And if you could just go and leave a rating or an honest feedback for us, we'd be much appreciative.
And we like to encourage our viewers that as you watch live, if you tweet out using the hashtag EduAllStars, we love seeing the conversations and hearing about different things that stick out to you. And if you're listening to the recording, we also encourage you to tweet out using the hashtag EduAllStars so we can learn with you throughout the week. Our guest this week is Nathan Barber, who is a 20-year educator and has served in a number of roles, including teacher, coach, and administrator. He's written and published 13 books, most of them in the field of education, along with a novel called Resurrecting Lazarus, Texas. Barber's most recent project is a manuscript called What Teachers Can Learn from Sports Coaches, a Playbook of Instructional Strategies. And we are so excited to talk to you, Nathan. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Hey, glad to be here, guys.
So, Nathan, the best place that we always like to start with our guests is just hearing a little bit about your background and how you ended up in education.
You bet. I have actually been in education now for over 20 years. I'm in my 21st year. And if I went backwards 21 years, 22 years, I kind of fell into it. Originally, I thought I'm going to teach for a few years while my wife is in school. And I actually ended up falling in love with teaching and staying there. So I kind of stumbled into it. I loved history, so I thought I'll teach history. And the more I taught it, the more I loved it and loved teaching kids, loved working with kids. Then had the opportunity to get into coaching, and I stayed in education, and here I am 21 years later.
When did you decide to kind of get out of the classroom and look into coaching and administration and take that route?
You know, the coaching came about 3 years into my teaching career, and had the opportunity to start with 7th grade B team girls basketball and moved up from there, eventually became a varsity girls basketball coach, did that for a long time. But one of my heads of school convinced me to try administration for a year. I was afraid it was going to affect my relationship with the kids, my relationship with the other teachers, maybe distract from the classroom, but he sort of twisted my arm, and I got into administration, and turned out I really loved it, and I realized that in the classroom I can affect a certain number of kids, but as an administrator I actually have an opportunity to affect a larger number of students at any one time and impact the rest of the teachers as well. And it turns out that I think maybe I was sort of born to be an administrator. I love it. Sometimes it's really tough, but it's very rewarding, and I don't see myself doing anything else, actually.
Let me ask you just a follow-up to that. Like, I always kind of feel like the administrator has to, you know, you're handling all the reactive stuff, and you don't necessarily get a chance to talk to the kids that are doing amazing stuff. Do you feel that way, or do you try to make a point to, like, yeah, I need to get in and talk to all kids?
No, that's a great question. In my role, I'm not limited from being in the classroom. I'm in classrooms all the time, observing, watching the teachers, watching kids. I'm in the hallways all the time, having conversations with kids. So it's not like I'm only dealing with kids when they're in trouble. We're very big on relationships at my school. So we work really hard, the rest of my administrative team and I, to build relationships, not only in the hallways, but in the classrooms, in the cafeteria, before school, after school, everywhere. So I get an opportunity to talk to kids all the time. If I ever got completely away from the kids, I think that's probably where I would have to hang it up and go back and make a pivot and do something a little bit different. I can't get away from the kids. As much as I love working with the teachers, I'm still in education for the kids, too.
I like now, the sports reference, too, the pivot. So
exactly.
You're a coach always, right?
Always.
Well, you know, I've been a teacher. I'm currently an administrator. I haven't been a coach. But looking at those three positions, what do you feel is the most difficult aspect of those, or which one was more difficult than another?
Wow, that's a really difficult question. Probably the administrator is the toughest of the three. I think there are similarities. I feel like as a teacher and a coach, you're guiding people, you're facilitating learning. But believe it or not, in addition to all of the paperwork and the sort of logistical pieces that we handle as an administrator, one of the things that I try to do, I try to be the academic leader, the academic visionary for the school, and being the facilitator of learning for my faculty is much the same role that I played when I was a coach, being a facilitator of learning of basketball skills for my players, and in the history classroom, a facilitator of learning for my history students. So in that sense, they're all very similar.
Cool. Talk to us about your book, Resurrecting Lazarus, Texas. First of all, I want to know, is it nonfiction or is it, I mean, or is it a fictional story?
Yeah, it is a novel, so it is fiction.
Okay.
And it is a story about, if you look at the title, Resurrecting Lazarus, Texas, obviously, if you're familiar with the Lazarus story in the Bible, there is a tragedy, but then there is reconciliation, there is a resurrection, a coming back to life. And so Lazarus, Texas is actually a fictional town set in the panhandle of West Texas. And the story centers on a young basketball coach, surprise, and his girls' basketball team in sort of a good old boys network, high school football is king, small town, and there's a tragedy in the town, and it really is sort of up to the basketball team to bring life and breathe life back into the town. So that's really kind of in a nutshell what's going on in Resurrecting Lazarus, Texas.
So where's the fictional part of that? Because all I heard was true story.
The fictional part is that all of the characters are fictional. Nobody is named after a real character, but I will say that much of it, I don't want to say it's autobiographical, but much of the content is drawn from experiences of my own life and characters that I have crossed paths with, both positive and some probably not so savory characters, and they're all sort of mixed together in this small town setting.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, so it sounds like. Did you ever imagine yourself as somebody who would be writing a book?
And I now did you've not. I actually, again, it's something I sort of stumbled into. Years ago, I'd have to stop and do the calculations, but before I actually wrote my first book, I was an advanced placement European history teacher. And back in the days, the early days of HTML, and you could take classes to learn how to create a website, a very primitive website. So I signed up for this class. And I was really bored. I was working ahead and honestly was really not paying attention to the teacher. I decided to work ahead and make my own AP European History website for my students and then also for other AP European History teachers and students around the country and eventually around the world. And a publisher found it and asked me if I would like to contribute some multiple choice questions to a book that they were writing about the AP European History exam. And of course, I was thrilled to do that. She was impressed with the website, primitive as it was. She was impressed and asked me to contribute. So I came home pretty excited. She contacted me that Friday and said, you know what, actually, we don't like any of the outlines that have been proposed for this book. Would you like to write an outline over the weekend and present it to see if we would be interested in doing the book the way that you would like to do the book? So I sort of burned the midnight oil over the weekend, put together a proposal. Believe it or not, they liked it, asked me to do the whole book, and that sort of launched the whole writing thing. So from that point forward, working with a couple of different educational companies and a handful of editors at these different publishers, I was able to do a number of books over the years. So that's kind of how I got into writing.
Now, you just recently released your newest book, though, What Teachers Can Learn from Sports Coaches, A Playbook of Instructional Strategies. Talk to us about that one and how that one came about and what exactly that deals with.
Absolutely. It's actually something that's sort of been brewing in my mind for a long time. I've had these ideas sort of swirling around. Of course, I do some blogging, and from time to time, I use the blog and use my writing to sort of hash out ideas and get some clarification on some things that I have in my head. And as I started doing some writing over the last several years, I've really drawn a lot of parallels between great teachers and great coaches that I've worked with in the past. I've had the fortune of being around some really top-notch coaches. I love reading. I love teachers. Love reading about John Wooden, for example. I thought about it. The more I realized there were really some significant parallels between what great coaches do and what teachers could do in the classroom topic, I wondered, is there enough material to create a book of great ideas drawn from great coaches, highly successful coaches, and make that for something useful for classroom teachers? So I began to interview and spend some time talking to and emailing back and forth with a number of coaches. The publisher liked the idea, so we went forward with the project. Next thing you know, about a year later, we have the manuscript. And it was a pretty rewarding experience. I got to really talk to some fantastic coaches during the process. I'm talking coaches with state championships, national championships, Olympic gold medals, with some pretty top-notch guys.
Wow.
And ladies.
Yeah, that's awesome. That sounds like a great project. just the research part of that.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And I have really cool. I have so much research left that I didn't use in the book that I'm hoping to use that in articles down the road. It's been really very rewarding.
Yeah, that's very cool. So how do you motivate maybe unmotivated kids or even unmotivated teachers being a principal?
Wow, that's a tricky question right there. As far as motivating kids, I think one of the biggest things that I have learned about motivating kids is that kids are motivated by things that interest them. And while we can't exactly make all of our high school experience sort of a cafeteria style where you can pick everything that you want to do, every place that we can find to allow students some choice in what they're doing, whether that is in the form of assessment or the topic that they're exploring, the book that they're reading, the more often that we can allow students to have some choice, then we can tap into some of that intrinsic motivation. I think intrinsic motivation provides a much more authentic experience for the kids. They stick with it longer. They tend to work harder. When everything is about extrinsic motivation, whether it's the threat of a bad grade or we're going to call your parents or something like that, that doesn't really genuinely motivate kids. But if you give them some choice, I think that's one of the greatest ways to motivate students about learning. Another way to really motivate students is if you can show how what you are doing is relevant and how it's going to be applicable to real life, I think then students can start to see the value in what you're doing, whether it's in the English classroom, social studies classroom, math class, PE, you name it. If you can show some relevance and some real-life application, then it becomes meaningful to the students, and they are more inclined to be motivated about doing whatever you're asking them to do. So I think that's probably the best way to motivate students who are having difficulty being motivated. With the adults, this is a really tough question. There is a point at which unmotivated adults probably are not going to become motivated. I am a big believer in growth mindset, but if you run into an adult who does not have a growth mindset, you're going to have a very difficult time motivating them sometimes. Sometimes we can use things like choice and give them options about maybe some things that they would like to teach or how they would like to teach, but motivating an unmotivated adult is a challenge.
Yeah,
I love that you use the term growth mindset, because we're reading this book this year as administrators in my district called Mindset by Carol Dweck, and just learning about all of the research and everything that goes into it and how you have to completely change the way you think and how you have to have that growth mindset to be successful and to grow and to learn. And it's a daily process thing. It's not a you were born with it or one day you have it, the next day you don't. I mean, you have to daily work at it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, I talk about Dweck's research in my book. If you look at the great coaches have a growth mindset. If there were no great growth mindset with great coaches, then they would assume that a team peaks at a certain point or players peak at a certain point, and they would not continue to work for improvement. And so that's why it's crucial for teachers to have a growth mindset, not only about their students, but about themselves as well. The teachers that I have experienced the embracing of the idea of growth mindset, they have grown as people, they've grown as educators, they've begun to take on leadership roles. Growth mindset for me is huge. I love Dweck's work, and I think that it's finally starting to become mainstream. I mean, her research has been around for years, but you're just now really starting to see the internet and social media inundated with research and writing about growth mindset, which I think is a fantastic thing because it shouldn't be kept a secret any longer.
Now, you coach basketball and you've talked about a growth mindset. Have you read the book Wooden about Coach John Wooden?
Yes, I've read that. I've read about three or four different books on John Wooden. I've also written the book about John Wooden's teaching, and that is fascinating to listen to him or to imagine him speaking and talking about teaching, talking about his role as a teacher, even when he referred to himself, he didn't refer to himself as a basketball coach. He referred to him, you know, quote, in my years teaching at UCLA, end quote. So he never talked about himself as a basketball coach. He always referred to himself as a teacher.
That book that he wrote, that was one of the best books I've read, and I just thought it was great. So I figured you'd heard of it, being a basketball coach and all.
Absolutely. John Wooden, on the court, off the court, absolutely fascinating individual, and he is first and foremost a teacher. It just happens that he teaches life lessons in basketball. He used to be an English teacher, actually, but he made his fame winning national championships at UCLA, obviously, but he was a teacher.
Mm-hmm. So what is something that you are reading right now?
You know what? I am actually reading fiction right now. I like to read a lot of young adult fiction. It gives me an opportunity to connect with the kids. But as far as professional work that I just read, I just finished a book called Change Just One Thing. And it is about changing the way that you question and the types of questions you ask. And it's a highly recommended book. I would definitely recommend that for anybody who's interested in the art of designing questions, because poor questions lead to poor answers, poor thought process. Great questions can really dig deep and challenge kids to motivate and push each other and to really dig deep within themselves and find answers. But the trick is asking the right question. And so that's what that book was all about. Highly recommend it.
Is that book written for young kids then?
No, it's not written for kids. It is written for teachers.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
So what young adult books are you reading? That's a nonfiction book. I'm interested in the young adult books that you're reading as well.
You know what? The one I just finished is called The Boy on the Wooden Box, and it's actually, I think, technically maybe a middle grades reader, but it is about the youngest boy who was on Schindler's List, and it is his memoir written just a few years ago about his experience during World War II and the Holocaust. And it is an absolutely powerful story, moving story, really interesting insight into Oskar Schindler and the work that he did to save so many Jews during the Holocaust. And that was the most recent one that I read. And I just put that down
Boy on the Wooden Box?
About 3 or 4 days ago. It was fantastic.
So what's awesome. Something that you can look back to and think like that you're super proud of accomplishing?
You know, I think personally my family, I mean, that's got to be first and foremost, you know, awesome wife, two fantastic kids, one in high school, one in middle school. I feel like we all have a very great relationship. So that's probably the thing I'm most proud of. You know, if my days on earth were numbered, that would be the thing that my legacy. If we're talking about professionally, I think probably the thing that I'm most proud of is watching the schools where I've been, watching the teachers grow, watching the kids grow. The school where I am right now, we've made a big shift towards innovation and experimentation and doing some things that are very out of the box, and watching teachers who had never thought about innovation before begin to innovate and create and take risks and generate crazy ideas that are really fantastic for kids and collaborate, that's probably professionally the thing that I'm most proud of.
So what's your next big goal then?
The next big goal... You know, one of the things that I've kind of tossed around is a follow-up to my current book on what teachers can learn from sports coaches, but to turn it back towards leadership and write it from the perspective of what can school leaders learn from sports coaches. Because if you look at some of the most successful coaches who run very large programs, there's a lot that goes into establishing a program, building a program, recruiting the right people, casting a vision, you know, inspecting what you expect. All of those things that go into the creation of a successful program, I think would translate well into school leadership. And so I'm beginning to explore that a little bit, to look at some coaches that might be good resources for me. So that may be the next thing on my plate.
Awesome. What's something you, like when you're having a really rough day, how do you kind of recenter yourself again?
That's a great question. Mountain biking. I go home and I put the mountain bike on the back of my truck and I head to the park and I get on the trails and I ride until I can't ride anymore.
But we all live in Houston, no mountains.
you know what? No mountains, but some great trails. There are a couple of
different
trails that I frequent And believe me, there are plenty. I don't need a mountain. The trails are challenging enough.
Yeah, exactly. I went out with my buddy a couple of years ago, and it's probably the first time I've been on a bike in a long time. And yeah, we just went over some trails over here. And, oh, it whipped me.
It's great. It's tough. It's very challenging, but I love it. It's great stress relief. It's great physical release. Mentally, it's challenging. It's something I feel like, back to the growth mindset, I feel like I improve every time I get on the trails, even if I'm riding the exact same trail. And it's just something that is right now probably the best stress relief for me. So when I have a tough day, that's one of the things that I do. But I'll tell you another secret, and I would challenge all of the educators to do this, especially those in leadership positions. If I'm having a tough morning, after lunch, the thing that I want to do most is I want to go sit in a classroom and be around kids. And being with the kids, I don't know, it's like a fountain of youth. It's rejuvenating. It keeps me focused. It reminds me about why I get up and go to work every day. So I know that sounds like a really cheesy, cliche answer, but the thing that I do in the school building when I'm having a difficult day, something challenging is going on, is I try to be around kids as much as possible.
So looking over the last year and everything that you've done and accomplished and all the great things that you've got to experience, what's been the biggest thing that you've learned in the last year?
Probably the biggest lesson I have learned in the last year is that collaboration is something that does not happen naturally for teachers. We talk all the time about how much we want, and I'm going to speak specifically about high school teachers. I know that elementary school teachers, middle school teachers, and high school teachers, even though we're all teachers, we all love kids, each of those groups is cut out of a different mold and has a little bit different persona. And I work specifically with high school teachers. And high school teachers tend to be content experts. You know, I am the expert in math. I don't need somebody to tell me how to do math better or how to teach better. That tends to be the persona. I know that's a stereotype, but if we're all being honest, there's a little bit of truth there. And so getting a group of seasoned veterans to gel with younger teachers and then collaborate, that has probably been the thing that I've learned the most, is it does not come naturally. We have to practice. As a school leader, I have to put our teachers in positions where they can practice. I have to give them some guidance and some rules on collaboration without setting the parameters too tight. So that's probably the biggest lesson I've learned, is about collaboration, how to take a group of individuals that maybe are not used to being on a team and really put them together. One of the things that I've done, in fact, I wrote about this on Edutopia, is we actually moved away from the traditional department chair model. So all of my academic departments at my school are functioning right now with no department chair. Everything is about the department as opposed to one person being the leader in that department. And that has been where I've really spent a lot of time reading and researching and diving into working on collaboration and building that teamwork at my school.
That's awesome. Did you get any pushback from that, like from teachers, or were they embracing that?
No, for the most part, we didn't get much pushback. We did get a few people who thought, I don't know how this is going to work. I'll believe it when I see it. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure what it's going to look like. And I think that anytime you talk about something that is new, that's probably the biggest fear, is you sometimes can't imagine what something is going to look like until you actually see it happen. Sure. So that's why it's really important to do all of the groundwork, have very clear communication, talk about expectations frequently, make sure that I am simple and clear when I give instructions or when I give challenges or set tasks or ask questions. We talk about simple and clear a lot, and that's something that's huge when it comes to collaboration. We need everybody sitting around the table to be very simple and very clear in both what they're saying and what they're asking. And I tell you what, I'm really, really proud of my teachers. They have done a fantastic job. Things are running just absolutely as smoothly as they could be.
Cool. I got a question. I'm going to change it a little bit, Todd. But like 10 or 20 years ago, if someone wanted to write a book, it was a difficult process, to say the least, I think. And now with, everyone can self-publish and do all these things, and you have access to marketplaces that were non-existent back then. Like, do you have any advice for maybe students, high school kids that are interested in writing books?
You know, the allure of self-publishing is pretty significant. In fact, that's the route that I went for Resurrecting Lazarus, Texas, simply because I wanted to try it. I wanted to see what it was all about. All of the other books that I've done up to that point were through traditional publishers, the whole nine yards with the contracts and the proposals and all of the things that go with it. it's not for everybody. It's not for the faint of heart. I think you have to be really stubborn to be successful going the self-publication route. I think you have to be really creative, and you have to be willing to spend a lot of time doing some things that publishers would normally do for you. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is much easier to publish a book than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. That is no guarantee of success. Now, the other side of that coin is traditional publication is no guarantee for success either. You still have to be pretty stubborn. But if I were going to give someone advice, it would be this. If you want to write, you need to start writing right now. Even if you're not going to publish what you're writing, you need to practice. It's like any other skill. You have to practice it. You have to work on it. And when you ask people to read it and give you feedback, you don't ask your mom, you don't ask your best friend, you don't ask your girlfriend, because they all have something at stake. You need to ask somebody who is an objective third party who will be brutally honest and say, this is fantastic, or wow, this stinks, you need to start over, or I have no idea what you're trying to communicate here, or anything in between. So getting honest feedback is really important. But you know, one of the things that to go back to the coaching, if you want to write, you need to have a writer's mentality. When I used to coach my girls, I would have kids who wanted to score. They liked the idea of scoring, but they didn't work hard enough to score. And we talked about having a scorer's mentality. You need to look for every possible opportunity to score with the ball. And the same thing applies for writing. If you want to write, you need to have a writer's mentality. You need to find ways to write. It could be writing for the school website. It could be writing for the yearbook. It could be a creative writing class at school. You can find a writer's guild in most of the large cities around pretty much anywhere in the United States. There are opportunities out there to write, but if you want to be successful at it, you need to write, have a writer's mentality. So that's my biggest advice, is be stubborn, persistent, have some grit and resilience, and write as much as you can, as often as you can, and eventually maybe good things are going to happen for you.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. We both have a friend, AJ Giuliani, who writes, I think he's, you know, he sits down and writes 1,500 words a day, and he tracks it with an app. You know, so if he doesn't do it one day, then he'll go back in the next day and write 3,000 words or whatever. But he's, you know, that's what he does. First thing in the morning, gets up and writes. And his blog is, he's an amazing writer, and it's because he has practiced so much. I mean, his blog is fantastic. He just really puts out really top-notch quality.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. For the writers who can really sit down and grind it out and really work at it and set up a routine, if you can set up a routine to write at the same time every day, the same place, that is fantastic. Not everybody has that luxury, but for the mm-hmm. people who can, that's an added bonus.
Well, you know, Nathan, the one question that we always like to end with all of our guests on is, what is something that you are passionate about right now?
The thing that I'm passionate about right now is innovation, specifically in the classroom. And I've been reading a lot about innovation. I've spent some time at a place called Olin College in Massachusetts, right outside Boston. I have done a number of, they're not really workshops, not really seminars, but I've spent quite a bit of time up there with some of their professors talking about innovation in higher ed, innovation in what they call pre-college, which is basically pre-K to 12. So innovation is something that is really the thing that is fueling my fire right now. That's kind of what I'm passionate about is innovation, and how do we make school more innovative, and that is a real challenge.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks, Nathan. We really appreciate you spending your Sunday evening with us, and I'm sure the listeners also appreciate it. It was a great conversation. How can listeners connect with you?
Listeners can connect with me a number of ways. You can find my website, nathanbarber.com. You can also find me on Twitter. I love Twitter. I tell people that all the time. I love Twitter. And it's @_NathanBarber. So make sure we get that underscore in there before my name. You can also find me on Facebook.
And lastly, you can connect with us through at Twitter, @EduAllStarsHQ. You can find all of our previous podcast episodes at eduallstars.com/podcast. And then if you just search out EduAllStars on iTunes, you can find out all the – we're on Stitcher Radio. I saw they tweeted out something today too, Todd. So, yeah, we're on Stitcher Radio now too. So if you listen to your consume your podcast that way, you can find them there.
Well, and we hope everybody joins us next Sunday at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time as we interview Colby Sharp. And then October 26th at 8 p.m., we interview Jenny Bukos. So make sure you check out those next two interviews. Again, thank you so much, Nathan, for coming on with us tonight. We really appreciate you spending some of your time to talk to us and share with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's great.